Well, thank you.
It's a privilege to come back. I'm glad to see that you didn't kick me out after 1 week. So I'll do my best to stay in good graces. Hearing your little comment about vacations reminds me of that great theological truth, just a vacation by faith. Sometimes that's what preachers get. We don't have enough money to go, but we have one by faith, just a vacation by faith. That's a great theological doctrine. Well, one thing I mentioned to Charles about doing this week is, as he's already said, a follow-up to last time. If you weren't here last time, we did talk about the exclusivity of Jesus. How is he the only way when there are so many religions and philosophies and other things? And that's just one of many questions that people have. Part of what I do nowadays is either one-on-one or in classes go around and answer a number of questions. I started doing this 20, 30 years ago based on a book called I'm Glad You Asked, written by Ken Boa. Great book, still out there. And basically, it came as a result of surveying non-believers to see what are your great questions. And it comes down to about 12. 12 basic questions get asked over and over again. And they jockey for first place every now and then, which one's the hottest one. And I'd love to ask you, if you've talked to people, what question do you think today, and it may vary from time to time, but what question would you say is the most asked question by skeptics, atheists, agnostics? What would you guess?
Is Jesus the only way?
Say again?
Is Jesus the only way?
That's probably number two. Yes. It bounces around there. It is, and it's the number one objection that I hear all the time, especially what's going on in the news. If there's an all-loving, all-powerful God, then why would he allow evil and suffering in the world? And it requires those two attributes of God. If he's all-loving, he has motive to see it stop. If he's all-powerful, he has the ability to make it stop. So why are we still see it? And maybe in a future date, if I make the cut again and come back, we'll tackle that one. That's the big one. And close second would be the one we covered last week. And then probably in there somewhere a lot of questions about the Bible. How can you say it was inspired of God? How do you know it wasn't copied incorrectly and unreliable and therefore? And these are the core issues that we believe as Christians. And so part of what I love to do is answer these questions for our sake so we have confidence, but also to be able to reflect that back to people. And what I'm going to share today in this issue is the follow-up to last week, but now the logical question is, okay, if that's true, if Jesus is the only way, what about those people who never hear? What about those people who are in a different religion and they're never allowed to even consider Christianity? What about those people? And it's typically some idea there's this guy on some remote part of the world who is void of any missionary, preacher, church, Bible, and it's a scenario. You know, it's always like, you know, not that these people that I'm talking to or maybe you're talking to are that concerned about them, because a lot of times I'll say, do you know somebody who's never heard? Should we mobilize an effort and go there right now? And they might be, you know, knowledgeable. They may know the unreached people groups in the world and say, we need to get the word to them. They're not concerned about their eternity. They use this question to try to avoid the exclusivity of Jesus. Because if Jesus is the only way, and this poor guy sits there on an island like that and never hears about Jesus, that's not fair, right? That always reminds me of an old joke. You've heard about the guy that got shipwrecked on an island like that, and years later he gets rescued. And as he comes by, the ship picks him up, and they look back to the island, and they see three huts on the island. And they say, well, what are those three huts? He says, well, the one on the left, that's the house that I built to live in. And the one next to that is the church that I built. And they said, what's the third one? He says, well, that's the church I used to go to. So like I say, the real question often isn't their concern for someone who's lost. The question is God fair? Right? Is God fair? Because if God's not fair, at least the biblical God, then I don't want anything to do with a God like that. Right? So if God is not fair, we don't want him. So I'm going to break it down into three possible answers to this question. The first one is, okay, God will not judge. Anyone who didn't hear about Jesus, they get a free pass. They can't be doomed to hell. They are not going to be judged at all. The second scenario is what most people think. God will judge. It's just not going to be fair. It's unfair. Therefore, we reject that kind of God. And what we want to build toward is this final conclusion that God will judge and it'll be fair. That's where we believe as biblical Christians that the answer lies. So let's look at the first one where God will not judge. And you will have probably had to make a case in previous conversations with your friend about Scripture being reliable, because we're going to rely on Scripture here. That Scripture makes it abundantly clear that God will make a judgment of all people. Here's a couple verses, Romans 5:16. The judgment arose from one transgression resulting in condemnation. Through one transgression, there resulted condemnation to all men. Can't be more clear than that. Through the one man's disobedience, many were made sinners. And then here's another one from Revelation. The dead were judged. This is all people. From the things which are written in the books according to their deeds. They were judged, every one of them, according to their deeds. I use that verse a lot with people when they say, you're saying Jesus is the only way to heaven? I say, actually, there are two ways to get to heaven. And evangelical Christians get upset when I say that. Because I say there is the possibility that you are judged by your deeds and you are perfect. You have never sinned. And then for the rest of us, there's Jesus. And you can talk to anybody, anywhere, and they will tell you they're not perfect. I've never had but one argument about that issue. I had a man run up to me one time after preaching somewhere in the South. I can't remember where. And if I did, I wouldn't tell you. And he didn't say he was perfect, but he said he hadn't sinned in the last 7 years. And you know what I said to him? I said, where's your wife? We can debunk this myth in a hurry. So the dead, all the dead will be judged based on deeds, right? And all of us will fall short. And those of us who've accepted Christ will be judged based on our personal relationship with Him, what He's done for us. But this is clear, all will be judged. And then, of course, the more famous one that you probably know from Hebrews is, it is appointed to men once to die, and after this comes judgment. Immediately after death. This is one of the reasons I don't believe in reincarnation. There is a death and then there's a judgment. There's a consequence from that judgment. So will there be a judgment? Absolutely. God will judge. And of course, I like to throw this out too in the conversation. If that were true, if God will not judge, then we should change our strategy tomorrow. We should run out of here. In fact, we should go right into the next worship service and we should stop any mention of the gospel. We should stop all evangelism, all world missions. We should burn all the tracts and other gospel media. We should eradicate the telling of the good news of Jesus Christ. Then in one generation, nobody would hear about Jesus. And then everybody would get the free pass to heaven, correct? No, there's a problem with that idea. And there's a thing called the Great Commission that Jesus made expressly clear that you and I go and tell people and make disciples. But if it were true that people without the hearing of the gospel got a free pass, and if we really cared about those people, we would shut up. We would stop telling about Jesus. But we don't do that, right? We've been told the other way to go and tell everybody we can. Ken Boa, who wrote the book, I'm Glad You Asked, has a great statement. He says, people are not lost because they've not heard. They are lost because they are sinners. Think about that. In the same way, we die because of disease, not because of ignorance of the proper cure. Isn't that true, doctors? We die from the disease we have, not because we didn't hear about a cure. Now, you can connect those two, but you are lost because of sin, not because you haven't heard. So we're all lost when we come into this thing called the human life, and we need help going forward. Well, what about the second scenario that God's going to judge? It's just going to be terribly unfair, horribly unfair. To that person, I say, well, God judges unlike human judges. He judges according to perfect knowledge. He knows everything about a person. You ask anybody that's ever sat as a judge over any proceeding, whether it's in our court system or in some kind of other setting, corporate, otherwise, they would say, I sure wish the jury, I sure wish myself, I wish we knew everything about this case. We had all the facts. We can only rely on evidence and testimony and expert witnesses and eyewitnesses. But we never know the full story whenever we render a verdict. But we don't have to worry about God because he perfectly judges based on perfect knowledge. Romans tells us there's no partiality with God. He judges the secrets of men through Christ Jesus. So there's not going to be any mistake in the judgment. So we have to ask the question, if God's going to judge, what does man need to have in order to have some idea about Jesus, to have some appeal to the gospel? And I think you'll agree with me. You can argue this point as we go through this. There's really only three things man needs to get to the place where he can just choose to accept Christ or not. First of all, man needs some knowledge of who God is. Not a complete theology, but the idea that there's a God who's awesome and powerful, but also perfect. Secondly, there has to be some knowledge of individual personal sin. And that creates the dilemma. If there's this all-perfect, all-powerful being called God, and I realize I'm sinful, frail humanity, what are my chances of having a relationship with him now and for all eternity? So then there'd have to be some knowledge of a solution. Knowledge of God, knowledge of personal sin, and knowledge of a solution. Would you agree that's all a person needs to move toward a decision for Christ? I'm not saying that just knowledge saves anybody. But in order to move toward Christ and make an informed decision, those three elements of knowledge. Can you think of anything else that you would add to that? I hope not, because I don't have it on the slide. But anyway. Any disagreement about that?
Well, it seemed like to me that the focus is on the last one.
Certainly.
The knowledge of the solution. Because, you know, people can look at the thunder and lightning, you know, and be, you know, think that God is in nature. You know, so there's a knowledge of a God. It just happens to be the wrong God.
What kind of God?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it gets tricky, but we'll see as we move through this that God has prepared a pretty bold display of all these three things. I saw a hand over here.
I think you need faith.
Well, that would be in response to that. I agree with you. Once a person gets to the place where there's a sense of God, a sense of sin, and there is a solution, then somebody's got to trust in that. And I think maybe another session we can come back. I have a whole session where I talk about what is faith. And faith is kind of sketchy in biblical understanding today. Not biblical understanding, but church understanding. What is faith? Well, just knowing something? No. It's the key word is trust. Rely. When you walked in here this morning, you didn't think about it. You plopped down in the same chairs that you plopped down into every week, right? You didn't test them. You didn't shake them. Right? You're shaking your head, you didn't plop in? Similar chair. They look the same. But what if Charles and I had conspired this morning to create a replica made out of balsa wood? It'd be a lot of work, right? And we put it where most of you are sitting in the back over there, you know. You're almost like Baptist over there, you're in the back over there. And you didn't think about it, you didn't put your weight on it and test it, but you sat down and you crushed it to the floor. That would be a bad scene. We'd have to call the 911 or somebody to come help you. But that would be because you put your faith on something that wasn't trustworthy. The next week you would probably come in here and check every chair to make sure it would hold you up. And that's what faith is. Faith is not removing all your doubts, but it's believing in the face of doubt. We could talk about that another session. But I want to build a case that these are the only three things you need to know to have a fair shot at judgment. So let's start with the first one. Most people would say, unlike what Charles said earlier, there are people in the world that are just totally ignorant of God. There's no way they can know about God. You Americans are fortunate. You grew up in a country where there's a church on every other corner, and you can hear about God. You can talk about God. And so you're fortunate. You have the evidence, but there are a lot of people that do not. Again, the Bible's pretty clear that there's a thing called external revelation. This is something Charles was referring to when it comes to weather. But we can go even further than the weather. Think about God from an engineering design standpoint. If he wanted to create a scenario in which he placed human beings that would one day come to know him, what kind of evidence would he leave for his being? and what kind of being he was. And of course, Psalm 19 is the clearest expression of that, where it says, the heavens declare the glory of God. And notice this is 24 preaching that we're going to see here in a minute. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. First half of the day. Day by day, they pour forth speech. Second half of the day. Night by night, they display knowledge. Long before we had any kind of telescopes or observational abilities like we have scientifically today, a person could go out and look at the sky, day sky, night sky, and see evidence of God. There's no speech or language where their voice is not heard. Their voice goes out into where? All the earth. The evidence of God is everywhere. Their words to where? The ends of the world. That guy on the island by himself, man, he has a lot of evidence. Looking up at night, looking at the ocean during the day, experiencing weather, experiencing other aspects, having food to eat along the shore. God has made a relentless external revelation of truth. And it's only gotten better since we got better telescopes like the Hubble telescope, when you can look out and see galaxies. Peter didn't have the advantage of this, but in Acts 14, when he's making his case before the men of Lystra, if you know the story, he and I think Silas went in there, and they actually got, through them, God healed this guy, and the Greek worshipers came up to him and called them Apollos and thought that they were gods themselves. And they said, no, we're not God. But let me tell you how you can know God. He says, we are also men of the same nature as you and preach the gospel to you in order that you should turn from these vain things, the other kind of religions, to what? A living God who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and all this in them. And in generations gone by, he permitted all nations to go their own way. In other words, you don't have to acknowledge the evidence. But notice what Peter added there. He said, this is Paul. And yet he did not leave himself what? Without witness. In all of the creation, in all of the nature that we see, Paul says in that great little city in Lystra, God didn't leave himself without a witness. He didn't leave himself without evidence, without testimony. So external revelation is a wonderful indication of God, but there's also internal revelation. Inside of each person, God has wired us in such a way that it begs for eternity. Augustine, I think, was the one who said, our hearts are restless until they find their rest in thee. There's a God-shaped void, and people can stuff any other thing in there they want to. They can stuff addictions like alcohol and drugs. They can stuff in their power and prestige. They can try to climb the ladder of success and call that their ultimate reality. I love what Vance Havner, the great Southern preacher, used to say about that. He said, you know, men are going to climb that ladder of success all the way to the top rung only to realize they've leaned it against the wrong wall. There's something God hardwired into all humanity, no matter where they're born, no matter where they grow up, that begs the question, where is this void to be filled? And Ecclesiastes probably sums it up best when it says, he, God, has also set eternity in the hearts of men. And I don't know about you, that's kicking in my life a lot. The older I get, the more I survey the landscape of our politics and our problems and our terrorism. I don't want to leave this earth any sooner than God has a plan for me, but boy, there's something in my heart that's syncopating and beating with a hope that is only fulfilled in heaven. Do you find yourself feeling that way sometimes? If you go back, I don't know what you sing mostly here in churches, but I love some of the old hymns, and they just scream, you know, yeah, this is a sojourn. Yeah, this is necessary. Yes, we're trudging through this land, but oh, when we all get to heaven, what a day of rejoicing that will be. And there's an eternity there that begs the question, I want to be met up with that. There was a question over here. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to add a comment. I have lots of friends who are people I've worked with that are pretty close to being hardcore atheists, and they would argue that all this stuff is just, you know, the result of random chance. And I haven't had the opportunity yet, but What comes back to me is Job, where God says to Job, who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now gird up your loins like a man, and I will ask you, and you instruct me. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? What more can you say?
Well,
you do it. If you really think that it could happen by random chance, then do it. Show us, you know.
You as a church have been blessed, and I was here when you had Dr. Hugh Ross come by here and speak. You know his story on this whole issue. He was one of the most brilliant astronomers Canada ever had. By the age of 18, was entrusted with a whole observatory. He was in charge. Not a Christian during that time. But at the age of 18, he decided, with all his scientific knowledge, he would see, is there any of the sacred literatures of any religion that come close to describing what we in scientific community see? And he started purposefully with everything except the Bible. He used the Quran and Book of Mormon and all these other sacred literatures. And then he ended up with the Bible, and he got to Job and Genesis, the first 12 chapters. And he says, yep, that all perfectly lines up with what we know in the astronomy community. He became a believer as a result of that. And as some of you recall, when he was here, he has a whole ministry now called Reason to Believe. And you can get the app on your phone. I used to have the app on my phone, and you set notifications to anything. And he told us, I think here, but I've heard him speak at apologetics conferences, that there are probably 40 to 100 discoveries a day in the scientific world, not just in astronomy, but in archaeology and so forth, that are all complementary or confirming of things in the Bible. And so I set my phone to receive all his notifications, and my phone was blowing up every day. And I had to turn it off. But it was fascinating to see that in all fields and disciplines of science, they're coming back and discovering external revelation. And so you're right. Job is where he went. He's written a whole book, by the way, Hugh Ross, a whole book on Job from a scientific standpoint.
I think he wrote Privileged Planet, too, didn't he? Or was that somebody else?
I'm not sure if that's his. He writes a book a year. He's so brilliant. I love to sit under his teaching all the time. That's why I stole a little seat in here when he was here. And I was one of those people that sat through both services, and we were told we weren't supposed to. Anyway. Dr. Hugh Ross. So, this is harder to explain. The external revelation is clear. You have to ignore the evidence of external revelation. The amount of that is overwhelming. Internal evidence is kind of hard to explain because some people just don't know exactly what we're talking about. But I've gone to people many times and just said, isn't there something unfulfilled in your life? Isn't there something that is, you've tried everything to try to make that satisfaction or that contentment happen, but you haven't seen it? I'll say, let me go ahead and advance you a little bit. You don't have to search too much further. That void is God. You're hardwired with this void so that you will seek him. No, they don't necessarily.
The rest of that verse.
Yeah, it's in your heart.
That's only half the verse.
Yeah. So are people completely ignorant of God? Well, no. The night sky, the evidence of science, the internal combustion of trying to find God is all there. Well, what about the ignorance of sin? Aren't there people in the world who just have never been taught? I love this discussion whenever, you know, it happens in America. There might be a crime family, and these young people grow up in a crime family in the inner city somewhere, and they never know a time when stealing is wrong. And so a teenage boy gets picked up on shoplifting, and they take him into lockup, and they take all his belongings away. They put him in a bag, and they'll scream, "You can't take that away from me. That's wrong." Well, how do you know that's wrong? You might say, "Good job. You stole from me," if you really thought stealing was okay. What about ignorance of sin? Well, C.S. Lewis has a tremendous amount of help here. If you've ever read Mere Christianity, he makes this whole argument for the existence of God. He came to a knowledge of God over the issue of morality. There are moral standards everywhere you go. In this particular time in history and throughout all history, people always establish that in some culture, in some way, in their laws or in their philosophies, that there's a right and there's a wrong. Well, where does that come from? Why do we call something right and something wrong? Because there is a sense of morality in all cultures. Romans makes this case when Paul says, "You therefore have no excuse, you who pass judgment on someone else, for at whatever point you judge another, you are condemning yourself, because you who pass judgment do the same things." You have a sense of judgment. You have a sense of right and wrong. There are moral standards. It's interesting, I did one of these meetings I call open forums over here at UNC many years ago at a fraternity. It was packed with all these bright, brilliant freshmen who know everything, right? And we had two guys there who were sociology majors. And on this point, we talked about this is one of the evidences for God, because people have a sense of right and wrong. And if you have a sense of right and wrong, there's a moral law. And if there's a moral law, there's an absolute moral law. And if there's an absolute moral law, there must be an absolute moral law giver, which points to God. There's a little thread you can follow there. That's C.S. Lewis's case in Mere Christianity. Well, these sociology brilliant freshmen raised their hand and said, well, I can explain why there's morality and laws of, you know, don't murder and don't rape in all cultures. I said, why? He brought out a word he'd learned that year, a combination word, social construct. You heard the word? Every society in their society, they construct some idea of what is advantageous to the culture. And certainly it's not advantageous to kill people. So we say don't murder. That's no sense of God. That's no sense of morality. That's just convenience. That makes the society work, social construct. Well, yes. Well, I didn't even argue his point, because I just backed it up. You know, I kicked the can further down the road. I said, okay, where did the concept of social construct come from? They didn't have an answer. I said, maybe God gives the concept of social construct. So you're back to the question, where did that come from? I love asking that question all the time. It's like evolution. When I talk to evolutionists, I always like to ask the question that bugs them, where did that come from? Where did that come from? Where did that come from? And ultimately, they get to a place where they can't answer it. And then they say, okay, but I'm going to ask you a question, where did God come from? I said, well, that's easy. God always was. And they say, well, that's not answering the question. I said, well, I can't answer the question. By definition, an eternal being never has a beginning. It didn't come from anything. So in this case, moral standards are established as evidence that there's judgment and condemnation that comes from knowing right and wrong from God. And of course, we could add to that another slightly different element, and that's conscience. Individually, even before you ever knew Christ, even before you read a verse of Scripture, you had a sense of what was right and wrong. Again, this is C.S. Lewis's argument in Mere Christianity. And here's the long verse in Romans 2 that talks about that, when Paul says, indeed, when Gentiles do not have the law, and they do by nature things required by the law, they are a law for themselves, even though they are not having the law. They show that the requirements of the law are written on their, where? Hearts. Here's the word, consciences always also bear witness, and their thoughts sometimes accuse them, and at other times even defending them. This will take place on the day when God judges people's secrets through Jesus Christ, as my gospel declares. Paul makes the eloquent argument in Romans that, again, you and I have sort of a basic, least common denominator sense of conscience that something's right and something's wrong. So those are two inward evidences of sin, moral standards and conscience. And again, Boa has a great line here where he says, the heathen then is not as ignorant as we might have thought. In his heart, he's aware of the eternal and omnipotent Creator, and he knows about his own moral guilt. And if he responds to these two truths, rather than suppressing them, he will be moving in the direction of our third part, God's solution. How can you live with that, by the way? If all you know is that there's a God and that you are sinful, can you rest with that? Can you suppress that? Can you create other religions to somehow explain that? Yes, the answer is yes to that. You can do that. But see, we're in a culture today, probably more than any other, where the element of human responsibility has been taken out of society. We are like passive victims in a culture that we have today. Everybody's taught that, you know, if in the case of religion, if God doesn't come with a big club and knock you over the head and get your attention and force you to believe him, then you are excused. But if I have a sense of there's a God, whether I have a defined theology or not, and I have a sense that I have some moral problem, some sin problem in my life, I have human responsibility to seek a solution.
Yeah, there's a very strong anchor that many people hang on to. It's their fault. And if they would straighten up, then society would be all right.
Yes.
So I've got it together. We just have to control them, whoever them is. So it becomes a kind of a excuse. That's why the world's messed up, because of them.
Right, yeah.
So it's a deflection. I'm okay if only they would straighten up or we can control them.
And they may be saying that about us.
Of course.
Of course. So, you know, even if we don't go into what God offers as solution, and even at this point, I think we have to say individuals around the world have a lot going around them to indicate a need for searching, a need for finding a solution. Now, they have to get the ultimate final solution, which is Jesus. But a process of searching. To me, I have always watched this in history, that whenever someone starts to seek, God begins to move toward them. That's true in my life. It's probably true in your life. And you think, oh, I did all this searching. Well, yeah, you took a baby step and God went 400 miles, basically. So are people really ignorant of a solution? And this is the point I was making earlier. Revelation requires a response. If things have been revealed to this individual about who God is and about who they are, they need to respond to that. And this is what I'm trying to say. Seekers will find. Seekers will find. You don't usually have on CNN or CBS or NBC News these incredible stories of people every day around the world who are making little steps toward God, and God, through people, through supernatural, through other means, are revealing the gospel today in massive quantities. That's not making headline news. But we know, biblically, we know in other situations where there's a heroic amount of effort God goes to bring one seeker the truth. Let me give you one illustration. There's multiple ones in the book of Acts, but this is one of my favorite. Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch. You know the story, Acts chapter 8. Here's Philip, who goes from Jerusalem down to Samaria. Down means down elevation. Jerusalem's the highest point in the country. So he's going north, but he's going downhill. And he goes up to Samaria with the hated Samaritans. The Jews and the Samaritans hated each other. But Philip is going with the gospel. And I'm not going to read all this, but you can read that later and see when he got there, he had an incredible ministry. There were unclean spirits coming out of people with shouts and loud noises. Paralyzed people were healed. There was so much rejoicing in that city. I want you to see that at the beginning of this story, Philip is doing a significant ministry. He's there for weeks, held over, you know, coming back and back and back. And God has him what seems to be in the sweet spot. And this next line makes no sense. But there was an Ethiopian eunuch, a court official of Candace, queen of Ethiopia, who was in charge of all the treasury. He had come to Jerusalem to worship. Now, don't miss out. By my estimation, this journey is at least 1,700 miles. And in those days, they didn't have fast-moving vehicles. They had slow-moving oxen. So I don't know how long this took. But he made an enormous journey to get to Jerusalem. And notice, he got there, and he was returning. What happened? He got to Jerusalem. We don't know when he got it, but he got a scroll. He could have had it back in Ethiopia. And if he was in this very influential royal court, they have libraries. We know at some point he has a scroll of the book of, anybody know?
Isaiah.
And he's trying to make sense of it. My guess is he left Ethiopia already with the scroll in hand, and he's purposefully going to Jerusalem to get explanation of Isaiah 53, the part that we will see later in Acts 8. He wants to know who this man is that the prophet is speaking about. What's going on here? He has some knowledge of God. He has some void in his life. And fortunately for him, he had the means. Not everybody can, but he made the 1,700-mile journey to Jerusalem to get his answers. And when the story unfolds in Acts 8, he hasn't gotten his answers. And he's headed home. Well, God knew this was going to happen. And so he's not going to let a seeker who is receiving revelation and responding, he's not going to let this guy go home without some truth. And so watch what happens next. An angel of the Lord spoke to Philip, saying, get up and go south to the road that descends from Jerusalem to Gaza. This is a desert road. Now, I don't have time to paint the poignancy of that moment. But Philip is enjoying great ministry, right? Weeks and weeks of seeing people delivered and coming into the gospel of Jesus Christ. And an angel shows up and says, leave this. Now, it really helps that it was an angel. I think that would always convince me. But there could have been a little discussion that's not included in the text. Philip could have said, now, you're not from around here, angel, but let me assure you, this is my sweet spot. This is where God is using me. But he didn't argue, did he? It just says that he got up and he went. And he gets down there, and this Ethiopian eunuch was sitting in his chair, and he was reading this prophet of Isaiah. And the Spirit said to Philip, okay, go up and join this chariot. He's getting directions on the fly. God is making sure this seeker is getting the pieces of the puzzle he needs. So he goes up and he says, do you understand what you're reading? See, in that day, people would read, even to themselves, but their lips would be moving. And so he could tell the guy was reading. Obviously, the scroll was there. The Ethiopian eunuch is not driving the chariot. We know that because later he's going to give commands to stop. So he's got freedom, and he's sitting there like some of us do in a car with our Kindle or whatever, if you can read and drive and not get car sick. And he's reading the scroll, and Philip engages him in a conversation. And the guy says, well, how can I understand this unless somebody guides him? And he invites Philip up into the chariot. Now, here's what he's reading. It's Isaiah 53. He was led as a sheep to slaughter and as a lamb before the shearers silent. So he does not open his mouth. In humiliation, his judgment was taken away. Who will relate his generation, for his life is removed from the earth? Philip says, I know who he's talking about. The eunuch answered Philip and said, please tell me, who's he talking about, himself or someone else? And Philip opened his mouth, and beginning with, from this scripture, not just ending with it, I think beginning with that, he preached to him what? The solution. We got seeker with some idea about God, some idea about his own personal need, making an effort to go and find out the answer. Doesn't seem to be getting the answer. God is a great chess player. He moves the board, any pieces he needs to get them where they need to. Even if he separates Philip from this incredible ministry in Samaria, he moves this one person from here to here. We're talking about 2,000 miles of distance that was covered. And we could talk about later Cornelius. We could talk about Lydia. There's great examples in the book of Acts of all this taking place. And of course, you know the rest of the story. They found water, and they must have talked about baptism because the eunuch says, hey, what prohibits me from being baptized? And Philip takes him down there and gets him baptized. And it says at the end of that, when they came up out of the water, the Spirit of the Lord snatched Philip away. I'm looking for that form of transportation. I would love to avoid airplanes from now on, but the Lord supernaturally transported him somewhere else. Ignorance of a solution? I don't think so. Because if someone responds to the revelation they have, they will find. God. I use the term breadcrumb trail all the time. I think God sets little pieces in front of us, and if we just take one piece, he puts another one, and another one, and another one. For some of us, it was a long breadcrumb trail. It took years and a lot of circumstances and a lot of people. Some of us, maybe four or five. Maybe we grew up in a Christian home and we didn't have to go far. But some of us can tell the story that we went 1,700 miles to find Jesus.
What's really interesting about that story is that in the beginning it says that he went up to Jerusalem to worship. So he was already a proselyte. He wasn't getting the answers.
He was close. And sometimes close is harder than far away. Like people who are already invested in a philosophy or religion, they think, well, I've got everything I need. So those are the harder ones for me. They think they've already got it figured out. But he was still seeking to the very end of when Philip showed up. Sure. There would be, like she says, proselytes. They're called God-fearers is what they were called. And they would beg, borrow, and choose between all kinds of religions. And we think from where he came from, especially in his transport all the way up there, you have a lot of commerce. You have a lot of people coming and going. And so ideas, philosophies all kind of come and go. It's interesting. It's in sort of that part of the world where we have a lot of Islamic stuff happening to this day.
Well, the other thing is you're forgetting Solomon. Queen of Sheba came from that area.
Yes.
And then took Judaism back with her. So there was a seed of Judaism already down there.
That's kind of why we think that scroll was there, already in possession. And maybe they had passed that around the court and said, you make sense of this? No, I can't make sense of this. Hey, well, let's get this guy to go up to Jerusalem and maybe we'll come back. See, I think he's the first African missionary. After God got a hold of him right there in the desert in Gaza, he goes back home and he says, now I got an answer. And God used him to break an entire continent open for the gospel. And that's why I think Philip was separated from Samaria. Yes, he's reaching thousands of people, but look what else can happen. He can reach tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands in a continent. Don't ever question God's chess playing. He moves the pieces exactly where they need to go. So there are missions and other means we can talk about. I'm going to run out of time if I don't hurry. One thing I'm going to add here is God always has an ace up his sleeve. It's called the supernatural. Because the argument often occurs where we say, you know, there's a country where they outlaw, it's a Muslim country. If you show up with a Bible or you share Jesus, they'll shoot you. So there are places where the gospel cannot penetrate. One of those countries in my day when I was a student here was Albania. It was the most atheistic country in the world. You could be shot on sight in the streets if you carried a Bible. Now it's one of the most open countries to the gospel in the world. God reverses things. Communism fell. All these things happen. God has a way, right? But even when there is human opposition to the gospel, there's always supernatural. I don't have time to go through it, but in these two most difficult religions to break into with the gospel, as you might guess, Islam and Hinduism, we are hearing stories every day from missionaries in those parts of the world where they hear of a person receiving Jesus Christ or coming out as a Christian, and there was no human element in that whole thing. One of the best books you can read on this is Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus by Nabil Qureshi. Nabil Qureshi grew up Islam, came to America for an education. I won't spoil the whole book to you, but basically he was being broken down in his Islamic faith until he was considering Christianity. And the end of his story is in a hotel room, Jesus showed up and completely brought him the full final picture of the gospel. And he now is a Christian apologist defending the faith. He can't go back home. He's under death threat. But the supernatural played a big part in his coming to faith. This is also true in Hinduism. There are two groups in Hinduism in India and other parts of the world that are coming to faith rapidly. One you would expect, and that is the lowest caste, the untouchables. Well, Hinduism's done nothing for them, and they're very receptive to missionaries. But the one you will not expect are the upper caste. And there are stories, I heard this years ago, and it continues to this day, of people who were not even seeking to know Jesus, awakened in the middle of the night with visions almost like Philip had of angels and Jesus himself standing at the foot of their bed, and they are radically converting to Christianity. God always has the supernatural ace up his sleeve where there are people who are finding the need to follow the breadcrumb trail. So we can't limit God when there's no human element. So what have we said here? Basically, that are people really ignorant of God? Well, no. There's external revelation. There's internal revelation. Are they ignorant of sin? Well, no, everybody has some sense of moral standards and some sense of conscience. What about solution? Well, no, if they respond to what little revelation they have in the first two, they will begin to find what they're seeking, and there's all these means of missions and other means. Or to sum it up this way, we could say every person has some knowledge of God, right? They're not completely innocent here, and they have some idea of their problem of sin. And they begin to reach a place where they have some need for a solution. I'm not saying today that we have people with a full orbed understanding of the gospel, but they have everything that should catapult them in a seeking mode. And if that's true, if anyone seeks to know the solution, the stories in the book of Acts and other places indicate that God will make sure that that person hears about Christ. God, who has perfect knowledge, will judge all persons after death based upon their knowledge of and response to the gospel. And so we can leave that in his hands. I want to make sure everybody has all the pieces. That's part of my responsibility as a Christian. That's part of my responsibility as someone who follows the Great Commission. And so I try to make myself available to that. I like to think of people coming into this world with a picture puzzle box. Unlike the picture puzzles that you put together at the beach, if some of you have been there this week or last week, they always have a picture on the cover that lets you know this is your goal. This is what you're supposed to end up with. The spiritual pieces of this box has no picture on the outside. They don't really know how it's supposed to end up. But when they're born, they get a few pieces from mom and dad. They go to church. They get a few pieces. They may read a book, read a Bible, take a religion course. And so they've got a whole box that's full of pieces of the puzzle, but they don't really know how they fit together. They certainly don't know what it's supposed to look like. And you and I meet these people. They're non-Christians, but they're informed. And if you ever have a spiritual conversation, it's tough because at some point, they pull out this box, metaphorically, and they shake it. And they say, don't tell me about the Bible, I know about the Bible. Or don't tell me about God, I know about God. But they don't really understand it fully. And they certainly don't know how it all fits together. My goal, your goal in these conversations is to love these people long enough that they would entrust you with the pieces of the puzzle. They would say, hey, you know, Steve, here's what I understand about God, about sin, about life, about everything else, but I don't see how it fits. And there's this beautiful moment metaphorically where they entrust you with their box. And you lovingly, gently open it up, and you don't gag when you see all the pieces in there that shouldn't fit. You just start putting them out. Hey, this is good. You've learned this well. Great. Now, here's a piece about works. I don't think we need that one. Let's set that aside. Let's see if we need that later. And gently, over multiple conversations, you put all the pieces out there that they have. Well, you're going to notice there's a lot of pieces missing, including the one that we talked about last week. Jesus is the only way. And here's why. So you reach into your pocket and you pull out pieces that you have that complete that picture. And then you just lay that out for them to see. And now they have to make a decision. I like that metaphor. I like to think of that gently, over time, doing that kind of thing. So what we've said today is that God will judge. It will be perfectly fair. And we don't have to worry about it. He sees it completely as is. If someone wants to try to get to heaven based on their deeds and their works, well, God's going to judge that completely and fairly. Unfortunately, we know none of us are perfect. And they better hope that the solution for their imperfection isn't their works, but the finished work of Jesus Christ. Now, one last thought, and we'll open up for a quick question. Here's something you've probably thought about. Well, what about people who are in other religions? They have some sense of God. They have some sense of their need. And they've been siphoned off by Islam, or they've been siphoned off by Hinduism. They're immersed in that, and they're going to stop their pursuit, right? Unfortunate, but that's what happens to people. But here's the problem. The religions of man, not God, the religions of man were not spawned out of a search for truth. Romans makes it clear that they're spawned out of a perversion of the truth that mankind originally had. Every major religion in the world, all 14 religions, minus Christianity, have basically started at that point of monotheism and branched off to pantheism, polytheism, whatever. And solution, not one man dying on a cross, but multiple deeds that man can do. Whether that's the five pillars of Islam, the Buddhist wheel, whatever. But I can sum it up this way, and this is something I try to share to my friend if they're of another religion. If they're involved in one of these other religions, I just say, well, you know, man-made religions basically minimize two essential truths. See if you agree with this. They minimize the horror of sin, and they minimize the holiness of God. They minimize the horror of sin. We're told in the Bible the wages of sin is death. In other religions, sin is kind of an imperfection or a little maladjustment or a little deficit in your life. They minimize the horror of sin. They have to, because their solution isn't going to take care of it. And they also minimize the holiness of God. God is not perfect, transcendent, sinless. He's what? He's kind of a doting grandfather, we said last week. Kind of sitting up there, he's a feel-good guy. You know, he doesn't want anybody to perish, and therefore he's going to let everybody in the end. Almost a universal salvation God. As opposed to what the Bible tells us about the holiness of God. Not that he's mean, but he has He has the qualities of a just judge. Here's what I always wrap it up. I said, Christianity is the only one, the only faith system that tells me, tells man the truth about sin, about God, and then offers man a solution. That's one of the best claims you can ever tell somebody. Christianity tells me the truth about who God is. Tells me the truth about my sin. And that might leave me in the desperation mode that Paul reflects in Romans when he said, woe is me, wretched man that I am. Who will deliver me from this body of death? But thanks be unto God for Christ who does. Christianity is the only one that does it. It's hard on sin. It's hard on the holiness of God. But it offers a solution. So like I said, these others are not true. We've gone through a process of elimination to end up with the fact that God will judge all people, and it'll be totally fair. Now, we're right at 9 o'clock. I don't know how much time we have, Charles. Are we done? Do we have time for a little question or comment?
I've got one.
Sure.
What's your take on the concept of age of accountability with children? For example, let's say we've got a 4-year-old girl, Hindu family, from a village, India, dies of cholera after a flood. She is a sinner. She's in another religion. She's never heard Jesus, never been taught. In your understanding, is there an age of accountability? Would she have to actually get to a point where she would be more cognizant of her sin and her need?
Absolutely. I don't know what the church here teaches, but I think there's at least three scriptures that point to an age of accountability. David's child that died, David clearly said, I will see that child again in heaven. Of all places, Jonah, at the very end when he's lamenting, should I not spare those who don't know their left hand from their right hand? That's a Hebrew idiom for youth, children who don't understand. And then actually John's peek into heaven in the book of Revelation when he saw people from every tongue, tribe, and nation. Well, that's not possible because not all tongues, tribes, and nations have heard the gospel and responded, but there's infant mortality in all these tribes and tongues and nations that ever lived. I don't want to specify what the age is. I don't think that's a fixed age, but I think a person has to have the ability, the capacity to understand God, to understand that. I think you could expand this to those who are mentally deficient, and they don't have the same requirement that someone like I have, that where I can process all that. So that's kind of a real quick answer. But I think Scripture backs up accountability, and I'll just stop at that before I get in trouble. Okay. Any other question, comment? You guys have been very gentle. Thank you. What we will try to do next time is talk about a final piece of this puzzle, which is, well, okay, well, what about works? All these other religions, when they offer a solution, it's not Jesus, it's some set of works and some level of performance of those works. How do you talk to someone today who's in even a denomination or two in the Christian faith that believe in this? How do we make a case that works don't work, but the finished work of the cross works? I think that's what we'll try to go for next week.